The third case for oral arguments this morning is Renee Longchamp's appellant versus Pamela Epgrave and Sanford Clinic Appellees. For the appellant is Mr. Ronald Parsons, Jr., an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee is Mr. Mark W. Hague, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Mr. Parsons, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Mr. Hague. This is a case in which all of the parties acting in good faith have a legitimate disagreement about the application of the medical privilege statutes in these particular circumstances. And involves an area of the law in which there is some discord about what is permitted and what is not permitted under those statutes. And I think the absence of controlling guidance has created a void of uncertainty in this area that's not good for anyone. And patients and medical facilities and doctors and lawyers aren't quite sure exactly what is allowed to occur and what isn't. And so this appeal, I think, presents a very good opportunity to provide some guidance on the issue of patient privacy and medical confidentiality and on how privileged medical information will be disclosed during the course of litigation.
Is this going to be an advisory opinion by the court then?
It won't be an advisory opinion, although I hope that it contains some advice. It will resolve the issue in this case.
That was lawyer talk.
Yeah. I'm guilty as charged on that. But I do think there's something for the court to do here, and that is settle the dispute that was the subject of the motion to compel hearing. And we suggest it was resolved incorrectly. I think it's important to note, too, that the issue of ex parte communications that are involved here, it doesn't involve, in this case at least, whether Misty Sanchez's relevant medical information will be disclosed during the course of litigation, but rather how that disclosure should occur. And it's our position that South Dakota's medical privilege statutes limit such disclosure to the authorized means of civil discovery under our rules of civil procedure in Chapter 15.6, and that they prohibit non-party witnesses, such as the nurses that were the witnesses in this case, from engaging in ex parte conferences with their patient's legal adversary. And we believe that that should be so, even in a case like this, where the non-party medical provider has a pre-existing attorney-client relationship with the law firm representing the defendants, because the medical privilege statutes make no exception for those circumstances. And that was the case here. Here, Misty Sanchez brought a claim against Dr. Epgrave for alleged medical negligence involving the delivery of her infant son who died following delivery. And she was an employee of Sanford Medical Center, which is a separate legal entity from Sanford Clinic, who was the employer of Dr. Epgrave. Dr. Epgrave and Sanford Clinic are represented in this action by the Davenport Law Firm, which is, of course, one of the best law firms in the state of South Dakota. And two of the critical witnesses in this case, however, the nurses, were in the delivery room, but they were employed by the medical center. And Davenport Law Firm also had a pre-existing attorney-client relationship with the medical center that employed these witnesses. So that's where the gray procedural or the gray area exists here, and that's why we need this court's help. At some point, a conclusion was reached that Davenport's pre-existing attorney-client relationship with the hospital, the medical center, trumped the medical privilege between the nurses and our client, Misty Sanchez, and so that the nurses were free to engage in ex parte conferences with their patient's legal adversary.
Where would you draw the line? Would you say that if the nurses had, and the doctor all had worked for the same entity, then the lawyers could talk to the nurses?
Yes, I think if you're part of the same discrete entity, I think yes. I think that is appropriate. I mean, you're obviously entitled to consult your own attorney. But where corporate lines have been drawn, I think that's where the line is drawn, and actually it's not a line drawn by the court, it's a line drawn by the corporations. I mean, they have drawn a line around themselves, saying we are a separate legal entity, and they enjoy all of the benefits and privileges of being a separate legal entity for legal purposes, including insulation from liability. And
how then are these separate corporations, the clinic and the hospital, supposed to share valuable patient information back and forth if you're saying they're legal entities and this is not allowed?
I think they're allowed to share legal information for the purpose of providing health care. But what we're talking about here is for the purpose of defeating a patient's medical malpractice claim. So I think that's a different context. We're not complaining that the nurses met with...
Well, you're only suggesting a partial piercing of the veil then?
Well, a partial piercing of the veil, but one related to the area of litigation. And that's all we're concerned about here.
Well, there isn't any, at least to my knowledge, there's no recognition in the attorney-client privilege in the doctrine that that draws distinctions with integrated corporate type business relationships.
None under South Dakota law, no. South Dakota law has evolved over the years, and it's evolved. The South Dakota legislature has increasingly made South Dakota law and the medical privilege more protective of patient privacy and more protective of confidentiality and less forgiving of the violation of that privilege. There's been a lot of confusion, and it's been the subject of law review articles, I'm sure the court's consulted, but for about the past 30 years, there were two different medical privilege statutes that for waiver of the medical privilege in the context of litigation, and lawyers didn't know which one applied, and they actually contained different provisions. And so since they didn't correspond with each other, it created tremendous confusion. But in 2001, the legislature took action, and the statutes were amended to create a formal process by which a patient could object in court and obtain an in-camera review prior to the disclosure of any medical information they thought might be irrelevant or that remained privileged, and allowed that to occur before it was released to opposing counsel. And then, in of course, not having that privilege, and you know, not allowing ex parte conversations or communications obviates that purpose of that statute, because if ex parte conversations are occurring, the patient doesn't know about them, and they don't know what's being disclosed, and they have no opportunity to object. So the entire purpose of that statute would be thwarted by allowing ex parte communications. And then in 2003, the legislature stepped in again and said, that's not enough. We need to clear up the confusion between these statutes, and it made them consistent with each other so that they both limited disclosure of privileged medical information only to trial and the authorized means of civil discovery under the rules of procedure. And so, and interestingly, the legislation was proposed by the state bar, and it was written by the state bar, and it was proposed for the precisely the reason that there was confusion about whether ex parte communications should be allowed or were allowed. Attorneys were not abiding by the statute by relying on the unclear statute. So really the critical, I think, principles regarding the medical privilege that have been laid down by this court and the legislature are that, you know, there's a longstanding in the highest echelon of public policy protecting patient confidentiality that really dates back, if you trace the history, to the territorial days of South Dakota and ancient Greece and the Hippocratic Oath on a more cosmopolitan scale.
What exactly are you suggesting, then, that the Davenport firm had no right to talk to the nurses, or that Mr. Johnson had the right to know what was said?
That the communications had to occur within the authorized means of civil discovery. And there had to be a deposition.
Even though there was an attorney-client relationship.
Yes. I think when we get in this area and we look at courts like the Baylander Court in Illinois, the Baylander decision, and Chief Judge Schreier's decision in the Deny case in Federal District Court in South Dakota, those cases set down the principle that the same attorney cannot represent both the defendant in a medical malpractice litigation or other litigation and a witness who is a treating physician, because that creates inherently the impossibility that there will be any barrier between the two hats that the attorney is wearing, one representing a critical witness who has physician-patient confidentiality and fiduciary obligations to her patient, and the other hat representing the defendant, who is the patient's legal adversary.
Is there any distinction whether the, I think like in Denai, it was one doctor treated and then a second, they didn't treat simultaneously. And here we have the nurses simultaneously in the delivery room with Dr. Epgrave. Is there a difference there?
I think it's highlighted. I think the distinction here highlights it because these are the critical witnesses in the case. And they are not defendants and they are not employees of any defendant. The distinction in the Denai case, that Chief Judge Schreier held it was not a violation of the medical privilege in that case. And she held it was not a violation because although the defendant physician and the treating physician were represented by attorneys retained by the same malpractice carrier, they were represented by separate attorneys. And she specifically held that there was an ethical obligation of the witness's attorney not to disclose any information to the defense attorney. And so she held that that barrier was sufficient to protect patient confidentiality. And that's the barrier we're asking this court to draw here, a line here. You can't represent the defendant and the witness who has his or her own obligations to the patient and is not a defendant.
Can't you, in part, then solve that problem by bringing a motion to disqualify counsel from representing other parties?
We could. I think we would need a legal basis to do that, and this court would be a question of first impression in South Dakota, I think. But we didn't know that there was consultation about the substance of the treatment with the nurses, and we still don't know whether that occurred or not. We, of course, knew that Davenport Law Firm routinely represents the clinic, that they represented Dr. F. Grave, and they also routinely represent the hospital.
But you asked them to schedule. You knew they were talking to the nurses because your firm asked Mr. Haig to line up the deposition.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that gets me to a procedural question. You've clarified in oral argument today that the relief you're requesting is that counsel may not represent in this situation and that there should have been a disqualification or something. You're not, but here's the procedural problem. The motion that was before the circuit court was a motion not to disqualify, a motion to find out what was said between Mr. Haig and the nurses. Similarly, you know, we're dealing with two top-notch, honest, ethical lawyers in this case.
Absolutely.
And at the time that this happened in the deposition, there was no reason to suspect that there was going to be an objection based on the conversation that was said or that someone was going to ask to be disqualified. Mr. Johnson's objection at the actual deposition was, you don't represent these people. You can't claim the privilege. So the questions that you're asking us to decide today weren't raised at the deposition, and it's not the motion that was decided by the trial court, a motion to compel disclosure of their testimony.
Well, I agree that the motion to compel disclosure would have been a predicate, I think, to the motion to disqualify. Now, certainly it was known that Davenport represented the Sanford Medical Center, and the depositions were scheduled through Mr. Haig. But it was not believed by Mr. Johnson, our law firm, that they were having ex parte communications with the nurses about Misty Sanchez's medical treatment. That was a surprise at the depositions to us. And we did not think that was permitted under the rules. Now, the rules are very gray.
Let's move to the motion.
Okay.
We only have a motion to compel what was discussed. We don't have a motion to disqualify. And like the Chief Justice's point, if you're going to make a motion to disqualify, it would seem to me that you should make it earlier in the litigation before Sanford and the Davenport firm has made their litigation strategy choices. I mean, they had to have decided early on who was going to represent who, and I'm going to take these witnesses, you take those. We need to ship this one out, we don't. Those are the kinds of decisions that are made early in litigation. And here, you know, the cow's already out of the barn by the time you're now asking us to make this decision.
That's very fair, and it's extremely fair. The motion to compel was brought immediately after the depositions, and the case has been on hold since then. So the first thing we were attempting to learn is whether there had been a violation of the privilege. And the rule we're asking for would prevent that from occurring because it would prohibit witnesses from being represented by defense attorneys in that case. So I understand there are some procedural things to navigate through, but I do think that this case is ripe for relief, and it's a perfect vehicle for this court to provide the type of guidance that all of us need on these sensitive issues.
Rather than giving under the guise of a decision of this court, what looks like could be an advisory opinion, wouldn't this be more appropriate to be brought as a proposed procedural rule through our rules hearings?
Well, I think the legislature has spoken as to what the rules are, and
not on attorney-client.
Well, they haven't mentioned attorney-client, but they have their failure to create an exception for the attorney-client relationship, the dual representation argument that's been advanced. There's no exception for that under the statute. So I would suggest that if that's an exception that Sanford Clinic or Sanford Hospital or other medical providers want to have to what the legislature has already ordained in the medical privilege statutes, then that's a discussion they should have with the legislature. The important thing about I also wanted to get into the peer review because I truly appreciate your concerns, Justice Zinter. This didn't happen until we found out that there were substantive communications or thought that there were at the deposition, and then we made the motion to compel. The discussions actually first occurred at what was a peer review meeting. And a peer review meeting occurred immediately after the death of Fidel Longchamps. And that was attended by Sanford Medical Clinic and the nurses and Sanford Medical Center and Dr. F. Grave and the Davenport Law Firm. And the purpose of peer review meetings are protected by statute because they are intended to encourage free discussion of everything that's occurred so doctors can feel secure about revealing everything that's happened so they can improve the quality of medical care from here on out. When you bring lawyers and medical malpractice attorneys into the peer review process, I think that process is inhibited. But if they want attorneys there, I'm sure they can have them there. But my concern is, though, then when privileged information is revealed at these peer review meetings where a defense attorney is attending, then that defense attorney should not then subsequently be able to take on the defense of that case. That violates the wall, I suggest.
These are all his clients, though, aren't they?
They're all their clients, but it happens all the time where there is a conflict between clients of the same law firm, and if it's the same issue, then you often have to hire another attorney.
Is that part of the relief you're asking from us today?
I'm asking. They've raised the peer review as a defense, and that's my counter to their argument. But the discussions then occurred again as they were being prepared for their depositions. So we have both instances we contend were potentially violative of the attorney-client privilege.
2 minutes, counsel.
I also just wanted to, touch briefly on HIPAA because that was raised in some of the amici briefs. There's an excellent law review article that I found in preparing for oral argument. It's by Beverly Cohen, and it's 43 Houston Law Review 1091. It's the winter 2006 issue. And it talks about, I think there's some suggestion by the amicis that HIPAA preempts this somehow. And that's just not so. HIPAA provides a floor by which medical providers must adhere to in terms of medical confidentiality. But there's a specific exemption in HIPAA that exempts state laws regarding state privacy. And anything, states are free to enact things that are much more stringent than HIPAA. And it's not preempted by HIPAA. And that's, in fact, what our legislature has chosen to do.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Mr. Haig, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, Mr. Parsons. Before I talk about what this appeal is about, I want to be very clear to the court what it's not about. I'm not before the court suggesting that the court adopt a rule that says defense counsel can go out and ex parte contact with treating physicians that they don't represent. I'm not suggesting that that happen. It's actually a very interesting issue. Mr. Parsons briefed a lot of that issue in his brief. He did a good job. There's some split among the states. There's lots of situations that occur where courts have addressed that, put limitations on that. But I want to be clear that that's not why I'm here today, and that's not what the appeal is. The issue before the court is whether an integrated healthcare system, such as Sanford, may use protective health information itself and with its own lawyers as is specifically allowed under federal law. And I want to be clear that there were some questions asked during Mr. Parsons' argument, but this is not any sort of a guise, as was suggested in some of the briefs. Davenport Law Firms represented Sanford Health for many, many years before I was born. They have lawyers, and we've developed special expertise with regard to how their system works. They've come to trust us. And we were representing Sanford Health, Sanford Clinic, and Sanford Medical Center on this very issue before any claim was brought, and before the plaintiffs hired an attorney in this case.
You know, I'd like to ask a little bit about, before you get much further, about the peer review thing. Now, I always thought that the peer review is a protected meeting between medical care professionals for the purpose of improving medical care. I never imagined that lawyers were part of the peer review process, and now I hear that in this case, the lawyer was present. I suppose it was you.
I was present.
Yeah, so does that then change the process? Is it still protected once the lawyer's in there talking about legal issues as opposed to what the peer review process was designed for?
Well, and I'm very glad you brought that up, because I noticed that the plaintiff's counsel suggested in their brief that the only reason lawyers would be there would be to prepare facts to address a malpractice case, and that's simply not true. In fact, if I want to investigate potential malpractice, I don't have to attend peer review. I would be able to go and talk to my clients and have the attorney-client privilege. So that's clearly not the reason I'm there. A lot of people aren't familiar with actually what peer review is, and I actually go quite commonly to peer review meetings at the request of the hospital or the clinic or the medical center, or the system itself.
And for what purpose are you there?
Three reasons, basically. First of all, if I could just step back and get to your question, Your Honor. Typically what happens at a peer review meeting is the medical providers meet and they discuss what happened, why did it happen, and most importantly, what steps could be taken, if any, to decide, is there some policy, is there some procedure, is there some equipment we could have, how could the system work better together, could one entity do something different, another entity, could they communicate? And the reason a lawyer is requested to be there by the hospital is for three reasons. One, in nearly every instance where there's a peer review proceeding and a lawsuit ensues, almost invariably now, we get a situation where the plaintiff's attorney requests to have that peer review information, and we have to go have a hearing and decide whether it's protected or not. So the first reason is the system wants an attorney there to be able to advise them and to be able to advise the employees who are there what needs to be done in order to maintain.
Well, I mean, let's just stop right there, though. Your explanation number one. We have consistently upheld the protection of the peer review committees. And I think we've consistently said lawyers cannot discover that as long as it's a peer review committee as opposed to something else. But now, it does sound like something else if the lawyer is present.
Well, I think, A, is at a peer review committee, and B, more importantly, why I'm there is typically to advise the employees who are there who have not been through this before that it's important that as peer review that it be maintained confidential and that they don't take notes and do things like that.
They always be employees, though? Wouldn't you have non-employees possibly in there if they're with was a practicing physician that wasn't an employee of your hospital or your network?
I think, Your Honor, I think that's probably possible off the top of my head. I'm not recalling it because most of the doctors...
You're then only your doctors and your employees of Sanford?
I would never say it has never happened. But in most cases, they are Sanford employees that are there. Because typically it's...
Of course, we don't know because it's all privilege.
Well, the judges, whenever these motions come up, the judges typically want to see the stuff, and we do provide that to them so they can see who was there and what was going on.
All right, so I interrupted you. You gave reason number one. Now what's reason number two and three?
Reason number two, Your Honor, and almost invariably when this is what happened, why did it happen, the next discussion and the most important part of the peer review process is what could be done to... if anything, to see that this doesn't happen again. If somebody comes up with, well, should we have this policy? Should we have this policy? I'm involved in assisting Sanford very commonly in drafting policies, and the purpose of the meeting is usually to say, well, you could do that, or no, that's not a good idea. I've seen another facility who's done this, and this happened, or here's something you might want to consider if you have this policy that could go wrong over here. And so I think I provide them important advice, and they look to me in those proceedings to determine whether this policy or that policy is something that they could do. And the third thing that I do, and I know the court only sees me typically on medical malpractice cases, but I do have other skills in terms of healthcare law and such, and it's good sometimes to have a lawyer there who's seen some of these things happen before, who knows how policies work, and actually sometimes ask questions that nobody else thinks of, because I think, oh, I've done this, a similar case happened over here. Let's look at this. Maybe this is something that could be changed. So I do think lawyers do add a valuable aspect to this in all of those ways. And I think it's important that in order to have good health care for patients, that they be able to engage in these peer review type of meetings, that they be able to have all the members of the integrated system there, and that they be able to rely on counsel when addressing whether they need to change a policy or whether there's something else that could be done. Because I do think, I'm not a doctor, but I do think that when I'm there, another lawyer from my firm, sir, we do provide important information that does help them improve the quality of health care to South Dakota citizens.
What happens, however, when it's obviously going to end up as a medical malpractice issue? Because then it takes on a different tone, I'm assuming.
I honestly, Your Honor, don't go there hoping to defend a medical malpractice action. Like you said, if a situation comes up and I need to do a separate investigation, I can go and do that. I don't think a peer review is any different if they think there's going to be malpractice or not. The purpose of the review, and the only reason they really have the review, is there something we should be doing differently to make sure this doesn't happen again? Is there something we need?
Isn't there a person in charge of the peer review? And what's his name or what's his task? What's his position?
Well, typically, there's always different people there, but typically Jeannie Schwarting, who is head of...
I don't mean the individual. I mean, what is it, the director, or is it... anyway, I'm talking about that person. Why can't you accomplish all the purposes you're trying to accomplish by being debriefed by that person, and then you make suggestions to them, and then they work it? It seems to me that you're completely changing the function of peer review, and we have had, as Justice Konerkamp said, we have protected the peer review policy to shut off the information. But if there's going to be a lawyer there and they're going to have these mixed signals, that's going to, in my mind, it's going to ruin the peer review policy, and it's going to change it into preparation for litigation.
And in answer to your question, Your Honor, I guess I would say yes. I think it's possible for whoever runs peer review to then call me when the meeting's over and say, you know, here's a suggestion that we had. But that becomes fairly inefficient and kind of defeats the purpose. If I say, you know, I'm not sure that's going to work because of this, that, or the other thing, if I was at the meeting, then someone could say, well, maybe we could tweak it this way or we could tweak it that way. So your suggestion would work, but I do think having me there is much more efficient in terms of trying to come up with workable solutions to problems. There's lots of non-medical people. I shouldn't say lots, but there are non-medical people there as well. Typically, somebody from the risk management department usually is the one who says, "Mr. Haig, can you come and attend this meeting? It's going to happen." Various other health personnel and non-health personnel are there. So I'm not the only non-doctor there, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
We've spent a lot of time discussing peer review. Do you have other points you wish to make?
Well, Your Honor, expires? Thank you. In 2003, the government enacted a very detailed set of federal regulations, which we all know as HIPAA. And it's very clear that HIPAA has contemplated this very issue. And it is very clear that HIPAA specifically allows integrated entities such as Sanford to share a patient's medical history both with its members and with its attorneys and its members' attorneys. And what we're here today doing is urging the court to interpret South Dakota law consistent with what HIPAA allows. Because, frankly, South Dakota has a statute that says there's a privilege, but there's really not much more in terms of guidance as to what the privilege is. And I know that Justice Konenkamp asked Mr. Parsons about, well, why is the corporation the entity or something like that? Part of the problem is that there's no definition under South Dakota law as to what is the entity for terms of the privilege. There's nothing in the law at all that suggests that the corporation itself is the entity. The only place you can look, because South Dakota doesn't have any law on that, is to HIPAA. And HIPAA clearly says that for purposes of protected health information, that an integrated health system such as Sanford can be considered one entity for purposes of sharing that information. And they're what's referred to under the regulations as an organized health care arrangement, or an OCA. And the HIPAA regulations say that they may designate themselves, which they have, as a single covered entity for purposes of subpart C and E. E is the regulation which refers to protected health information. And that's 45 CFR 164.105B1. The regulations go farther and they say that an OCA such as Sanford is specifically permitted to share protected patient information among members of the OCA for any healthcare operation activities which specifically, under the definitions, includes legal services. And not only are they permitted to share the information, they're actually, if you read through the regulations, the integrated health system is encouraged to share the information because that improves the quality of health care that's offered to South Dakotans. For example, under federal law, under HIPAA, Sanford Health is organized to include a single legal department which oversees the entire Sanford integrated network. Plaintiff is suggesting that these integrated health entities can't share health information, and the way that Sanford is organized, it would make it very difficult for them to organize. If you take away the administration of the integrated entity, you take away the value in integrating these entities, which is that the services can be integrated, for lack of a better word, that they can cooperate and provide the best healthcare services. In fact, when patients are treated at any Sanford entity, as required by HIPAA, they are given and required to sign an acknowledgement of Sanford's privacy policies, which specifically advises the patients that their health information will be shared among the member entities and that they can be used for a number of different reasons, including judicial or administrative proceedings. So the patients are even told that when they go in, that these are the regulations that Sanford operates under. And I think it's beyond reasonable debate, and I'm not sure Mr. Parsons even contends otherwise, that HIPAA allows us to do this. And he's suggesting, I think, that South Dakota adopt regulations more stringent and different than HIPAA and not allow integrated health facilities to operate as a single unit. And I think that there is no reason to adopt that, and I think that would be detrimental to health care in South Dakota not to allow the free flow of information between the integrated units.
Mr. Haig, though, your argument up to this point is focusing almost exclusively on the attorney-client privilege. But we also have the medical privilege here. And in your brief, it's kind of the same way. You focus on attorney-client and devote little time to the, or not little, but less time to the medical issue. Your opponent does the opposite. Now, given HIPAA and given the policies or that maybe come from that about integrated systems, isn't that still ignoring language in the medical statute that says when there is a waiver of a medical privilege, it's for the purposes of discovery under Chapter 15.6. And, of course, if the medical waiver occurs under Chapter 15.6, that means according to the rules of discovery, which means the formal rules of discovery. How do you answer that?
I answer that, Your Honor, by saying that in order to look at the rule and the waiver statutes and the privilege statutes under South Dakota law, you first have to look and determine what is the entity that holds the privilege. And we are saying very clearly that the entity should be the Sanford Integrated Health System that holds the privilege. And at no point did they release information outside of that entity. Mr. Carson says the entity should be each individual corporation.
Now, you hold which privilege? Let's be specific. You're again talking about the attorney-client privilege now.
No, I'm talking about the physician-patient privilege.
Okay, all right.
I believe what I'm saying, Your Honor, is the entity that holds the privilege is Sanford Integrated Health. As HIPAA specifically says, that's the entity. You should not disclose the information outside of the Sanford Health System.
It's the patient's privilege, though.
Correct. We are protecting that privilege by not disclosing that privilege outside of the entity, which in this case is Sanford Health System.
But again, this case is about the manner of discovery, and the statute, the medical statute, says under 15.6.
I understand that, and I guess I'm admitting, Your Honor, that under that language, if I'm representing Sanford Health, I shouldn't drive over to McKinnon Hospital and talk to one of McKinnon's doctors. They shouldn't disclose that information to me, and I don't do that. But since the entity is the system and the entire system is my client, I believe that a medical provider does have the right under South Dakota law and under HIPAA, clearly, to discuss information with their attorneys. And all they're doing in this case is the Sanford Health System is discussing the information with their attorneys. And that adds... Your Honor, there are a lot of, maybe I'm getting far afield of your question, but there are a lot of, we take the privilege very seriously and we protect the privilege. And in this case, at no time was the medical information disclosed outside of the entity, the integrated entity of Sanford Health. But there are a lot of ways that are not recognized in the statute when information is protected information is disclosed and it's just seen as being acceptable. For instance, when you want your bill paid by your health insurance company, your medical provider discloses your information to your health care provider. If a doctor gets sued, there's nowhere in state law that says if you get sued, you can go talk to your lawyer about it. If you read the statute strictly, a doctor couldn't even talk to his own lawyer about the privilege because there's nothing in the statute that says there's a waiver for a doctor to go talk to his lawyer. But we think that's recognized clearly under the law, and we think Sanford as an entity should be able to speak to its lawyers about this. And I guess my time's running out. I'm on page two of my argument. If I could just say a couple things, three things. One, Mr. Hurd wrote an excellent, excellent brief for the South Dakota Health, or the SDAHO, which I think nails the issue, and I would urge the court to review that. Two, I want to be clear that what Mr. Parsons is asking this court to do is to create a rule of law that is not recognized by any other state or jurisdiction in the nation. He has cited none. I've done a lot of research. I have found none. No other state prohibits an integrated health system from sharing information among itself and with its lawyers. And I wanted to talk about how important the sharing of information is, and particularly to a rural community such as South Dakota, because when you cut that off, when you don't allow the, if I'm in an accident in Chamberlain, to get information, get on their computer and get protected information from the entity and treat me, you're making health care worse for South Dakotans. Clearly HIPAA has looked at this, understands that integrated health systems are going to occur, and we would urge the court to affirm the trial court's ruling.
Thank you, Mr. Haig. Mr. Parsons, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I want to be very clear that this case does not involve at all any attempt by the plaintiff or any request that this court interfere with the exchange of information among all of the entities of Sanford Health. We're not asking this court to stop any information flowing between any entity of Sanford Health, between any doctor, between the clinic or the hospital. So any decision by this court enforcing South Dakota's medical waiver statutes will not interfere with the flow of information between those entities. What it could interfere with, and what we're asking this court to interfere with in very limited circumstances, is the flow of information between the entities of Sanford Hospital, Sanford Medical Center, and the Davenport Law Firm. What we're asking for is limitations on what may be disclosed to a patient's legal adversary. And the fact that...
Let me ask you this, though. And counsel's comment's kind of sticking in my head, and I'd like you to address that. He says that you're asking us to adopt a rule that doesn't exist anywhere else. Is that true?
I think that's absolutely not true. We're asking this court to reject an exception to a state law that I'm aware no state has made. The court, I mean, Mr. Haig is asking this court to impose federal HIPAA law on South Dakota's medical waiver statutes. But state law does not bend to the federal definitions of what does or does not violate HIPAA. And in fact, it's exactly the contrary. When Congress passed HIPAA, if you look at 45 CFR 160.203B and .202, they make express rejection of any attempt to say that HIPAA would ever preempt state laws that are more stringent and more protective of patient privacy. So states are complete. HIPAA sets a floor that everyone has to abide by, but states are utterly free, expressly free, under the statute Congress authorized to impose greater protections on patient privacy. And most states have, and South Dakota certainly has, and South Dakota has paid a lot of attention to it in the legislature in the past three or four terms. And they keep making it more stringent and more protective. And they require that before a treating physician can reveal medical information, there has to be an opportunity for the patient to say, wait a minute, I object to that. That might be extremely embarrassing, humiliating, has nothing to do with this lawsuit. I want the court to review it before it's disclosed to the patient's legal adversary's lawyer. And I totally understand that this is a tricky situation because Sanford hires Davenport to do almost everything for it. But it's very convenient for Sanford to do that, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that it's convenient to have the Davenport Law Firm represent everybody. But sometimes convenience has to give way to paramount concerns, the paramount concerns of patient privacy. And all we're asking here is that the South Dakota statutes as written be enforced, and that when a separate corporate entity under South Dakota law wants to disclose privileged medical information, that that has to be done with notice to the patient in a deposition or through other authorized discovery. And that's all we're asking here. Will not interfere whatsoever with how Sanford does business. It might interfere in very limited occasions with who the Davenport Law Firm can represent in litigation. And that's
it. A separate corporate entity seems like an artificial line drawing, though, to me. I mean, suppose tomorrow if Sanford wanted, they could integrate all this into one corporation, and that would take away your argument.
A corporation is inherently an artificial. It's a legal fiction, but it's one that they choose for themselves. It's the way they define themselves in order to limit their exposure, limit their liability.
But how does your client rely upon that? I mean, how does your client depend upon those line, that particular line in order to protect her privacy?
Well, I think she takes it a step backwards. She relies on the fact that her nurses are going to protect her patient privilege.
She had no idea that the nurses worked for a different entity than the doctor.
She didn't know. She didn't know either way. That's true. But she assumes, and I think we have to give all patients the benefit of the assumption, that their privilege information won't be released to their legal adversaries without an opportunity to object.
Certainly she did sign this document when she was treated, though, that she knew that this information was going to be shared.
It was going to be shared, not with, not outside, not to her legal adversary in a potential lawsuit. And that's what the statutes cover. That's what our medical privilege statutes cover.
Was there a comment in there about administrative and judicial proceedings in that way in the document she signed?
I'm not familiar with that, but I don't think it that trumps South Dakota law. And you know, I understand that a corporation is an artificial legal fiction, but that's where we have to be. I mean.
So you're saying that if they reorganize tomorrow into one large corporation, Sanford Inc., your argument goes away.
It might. It might. Yeah. It very well might. I'm sure there's reasons that they've chosen to separate themselves that way. I'm recalled here at the law school. I remember Professor Day's class talking about South Dakota versus Dole. Chief Justice Rehnquist saying, "You have to take the bitter with the sweet. If South Dakota wants highway funds, then they have to accept the conditions that go along with those funds. If the Sanford Medical Clinic wants to be a separate corporate entity, insulated from liability from anything that Sanford Hospital does, there's no relation between their employees in terms of legal liability and all the other financial benefits I assume they gain from that. There are a few obligations that go with that, and one is the burden imposed upon Sanford that they have to take a deposition of a witness in a medical malpractice case rather than having ex parte communications. So I think that's a very small burden, and it's a small thing we're asking.
Okay, let's say you win. So how do we do this in the future? You're asking us for guidance. In the future, if this comes up again, what is an attorney supposed to do that represents a hospital?
I think that if an attorney obtains privileged information from a non-party in a lawsuit, they cannot, a witness, they cannot then subsequently defend that lawsuit. And I think that an attorney cannot represent both a defendant in a medical malpractice lawsuit and a treating physician or another medical provider who is a witness without a waiver of the privilege, without authorization.
You're talking about a non-party witness.
A non-party witness, exactly. Non-parties. I appreciate all of the nuances that are here, and there's no suggestion that anyone's done anything improper here. I totally understand how we all need guidance, and that's why we brought this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Just a reminder, we have the publications available, if you wish, for free in the lobby. And with that, we're in recess.